Spirit Blade Underground, episode 313. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 313.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and very unique community you're invited to check out at ChristianGeekCentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more information and free goodies, check out SpiritBlade.net. For now, though, I've got a review of Knights of Badassdom coming at you in a second, and I'm also going to take us again into the book of Hebrews, and found some interesting things there that I think apply to us geeks, specifically what geeks maybe should really be doing to relax and just kind of settle down and be at peace, as it were. So anyway, yeah, we'll get into that. That's all. All right, here we go.
At last, the power of the dragon amulet is mine. It overwhelms your feeble defenses. You will now agree with all of my opinions and everything I say, even if it sounds stupid and wrong.
Well, a few weeks ago, I watched Knights of Badassdom, which I wasn't able to find like on Redbox. I don't know if it's on Netflix. I paid for the digital rental on Amazon for a few bucks. And this is like an independent film, if you haven't heard of this, that the production kind of got slowed down for a while, and eventually it was released, and there has been a lot of anticipation because there's a lot of familiar faces, especially in, I don't want to say in geek culture. Summer Glau is one example. I mean, certainly she's got a lot of geek cred. But other, you know, actors that have been in some kind of, you know, I guess like hip comedies and stuff, you know. The story is about a group of LARPers who take their friend Joe out for a weekend of LARPing. Joe's never been LARPing before, but he used to play D&D back in the day, and his girlfriend just broke up with him, so he's all bummed out, and they're like, we're going to fix him up. We're going to take him for this awesome, unforgettable weekend of LARPing. And during this weekend of LARPing, one of the people that's a part of the whole weekend of fun and excitement, in order to bring more authenticity to the environment as a, you know, as they're playing a spellcaster, brings this mysterious old creepy book that they found a while back and decide to read out of it during the during a spellcasting ritual. And of course, that leads to, and I'm not telling you anything that's not in the trailer, that leads to the actual summoning of an actual succubus, a demon from hell, which then wreaks havoc on the camp of LARPers, and they have to deal now with this very real situation. I think it's got a great cast, and the performances are all really solid, I think. You know, you've got, let's see, Ryan Kwanten, I don't know this guy, he plays Joe, which is the down-on-his-luck guy that his friends take out for the weekend. He looks familiar. I keep wanting to think that he's Ryan Reynolds, you know, like a young Ryan Reynolds time traveling into the future a little bit. But yeah, I got just a little bit of vibe. I've seen him somewhere else, though, I think. You'll recognize Steve Zahn or Zan. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, but you'll recognize him. He often plays supporting comedic roles, and he plays Joe's friend Eric in this movie, who Eric is the spellcaster that unleashes the demon. Peter Dinklage, who you'll recognize, he's probably one of the most like highly sought after little people actors in the industry today, and he does a great job, as he does a solid job in all of his roles, and he brings a lot of great charm to this performance as well. He plays Hung. Summer Glau plays Gwen, a girl that they meet, a woman, gal, whatever she is. It's funny, she's kind of in that 20s, 30s stage where lots of actors kind of seem to be immortal for a little while. So, I mean, she looks the same to me as she has for the last 15 years about. So anyway, she's like, you know, another LARPer that they meet, and it's kind of like the love interest, I guess you might say. Jimmy Simpson, another face you'll probably recognize. He just kind of plays these quirky, unusual character type people. He plays Ronnie in this one, who's a little bit of kind of the enemy, the guy that they don't get along with. And, you know, he's, but anyway, you know, so it's got these familiar faces. It's got some pretty solid performances. It's got a few light character moments that gave me reason to care and invest in who these people were. Gwen, her character, is looking after her cousin, who for the longest time has been really socially withdrawn. If I remember correctly, there was like some kind of traumatic event that happened, and now basically he just always kind of lives in the game, and he's kind of in that mentality the whole time, you know. And, you know, so I'm not sure. I've never met anybody like that, but it was still kind of this endearing kind of thing to think that, you know, she's taking care of, you know, her cousin, kind of looking after him, and she's not really super hardcore nerd herself, but she gets into it enough because she cares about her cousin, you know. And so there's little bits like that that made me care about these characters. There's some decent lighting. There are some good laughs. There's a, you know, a few interesting use of text effects as they kind of have little plus ones and plus twos show up during combat moments, or at least during a combat training sequence. I can't remember if they used it after that. Overall production values were good for a film of this very specific nature and budget. In general, it's because of like the very limited crowd that this is going to appeal to, or that's going to be of particular interest to, maybe I should say, you know, it's worth watching at some point, maybe, you know, while you're dinking around on your computer, you can fire this up and, you know, have it running in the background or something. You could probably tell from my tone of voice that I was not blown away by this movie. I wasn't a person that was like waiting in great anticipation of it, but I mean, you know, it's a movie about like totally nerding out and LARPing, you know, so I'm totally going to see that. But here's what's going on. I think the script is mostly a dud. There are very few funny jokes, although I do have to add to that that I'm the type of person that it takes something really unusual to make me laugh in a comedy. I don't watch comedies very often because comedies typically do not make me laugh. So take that a little bit with a grain of salt, I guess, when I say that there are very few what I would consider funny jokes. But it does, to me, really seem to fall flat. It's got a climax that I'm not sure what they were going for. It seems to me like they're aiming for Tenacious D in the Pick of Destiny, to which I'm like, guys, just leave it to the D, you know? And which, by the way, that's a really hard movie, Tenacious D in the Pick of Destiny. Really hard movie to recommend to anybody, but for those that can stomach the constant barrage of F-bombs and some of the crass humor and stuff, I think they pull off the kind of humor they're aiming for a lot more effectively than the climax of Knights of Badassdom does. The CG is TV quality at best. If that doesn't bother you, if you go into this expecting, okay, I'm going to watch an independent film, I'm going to watch a low-budget film, then I think you can adjust your expectations and just go along for the ride. And for me, when I'm watching a comedy, I'm not expecting as much from the visual effects. I'm not expecting for that sense of realism to really be taken in, especially a comedy like this one. And realism is really, I think, the key reason that this movie really doesn't take off. It doesn't commit to realism or to comedic fantasy. If it was committing to like this completely, you know, absurd kind of comedy, then I think it would have been funnier. I think it would have been more enjoyable. But there are some surprisingly real emotional moments. For example, when one character dies, I won't say who, I was like, oh my gosh, this is really getting some weight in the story here, in the drama, you know. But very soon after that, they're all being overly courageous nerds again, in light of this very real danger and this, you know, real supernatural craziness that's going on, I kind of wish that death that took place, that they wouldn't have brought any of those heavier moments in. It's a rare comedy that can make both heavy moments and outlandish comedy work well. I would say Shaun of the Dead is an example of a movie that somehow, and I couldn't even tell you how they pull it off, but somehow in a movie like Shaun of the Dead, they can give you these crazy comedic moments and then have this really intense emotional moment, you know, when you're dealing with death or someone that you're having to say goodbye to for the very last time. And they just didn't pull that off here. I also felt, now I have very little exposure to LARPing. I've seen some of it going on at conventions. I've not been to like a weekend LARP, and I've not participated, you know, a weekend LARP where they go out somewhere else, you know, where they're out in the woods or in nature or something like that, you know. And I've not participated in one ever myself, but all the impressions I've gotten from LARPing lead me to believe that the representation of it in this movie is like extravagant, you know, like they have these costumes and effects, you know, that they've brought, like pyro effects and all this kind of stuff, you know, that is just kind of like more than the average LARP would ever have, you know. So I'm not sure that it was a good representation, even an inflated comedic representation of actual LARP culture. And I think that's what I would have liked more. I would have liked more of, I feel like the filmmakers, to a degree, were representing nerd culture from the outside. And what I would like, you know, when you're going to make a movie about freaking LARPing, that's not a good impression to give, you know, because your audience is going to be people that are into nerdy stuff. Even if they're not LARPers themselves, I'm not a LARPer myself, but I'm into nerdy stuff and I celebrate nerd culture. I don't poo-poo it. I don't make fun of it, you know, except maybe in the sense of like, you know, I'm a nerd too, you know, so I'm making fun of myself along with it. But in most cases, I certainly don't look down on, you know, LARPing or role-playing and stuff like that. And there are certain moments in this where I was just kind of wondering, are the filmmakers, are they kind of a little bit looking, you know, on this culture from the outside? Most of the cast still seemed like they could be the popular kids at school, you know what I mean? Instead of the outcast hardcore nerds. Now, that's not to say that, you know, you don't have some people in LARPing and in role-playing and nerd culture that couldn't also fit in into kind of that mainstream culture. But I felt like it was way overloaded in this movie with people that just come across as mainstream, as Hollywood body types. Let me just say that, you know, like there were very few people that were not in really great shape in this movie. And I'm not saying, you know, that we should, you know, have these all these overweight, you know, characters across the board. But, you know, most of the people that I hang out with that are nerds, we're not physical specimens, okay? We don't spend time working out. We don't have great complexion, you know, and but neither do I want them to do like these caricatures. I would just love, like, you know, them to cast actors and performers in an ensemble cast like this that actually looked and acted, you know, in maybe just a slightly heightened way, like the nerds I hang out with. But I didn't feel like that's what was going on here. I felt like they were, you know, doing their version of nerds they've seen doing nerdy stuff online, you know. And there's even a moment, I can't remember if it was in the movie or just in the trailer, where I guess it's kind of like an internet sensation of this LARPer playing a wizard, throwing little like yellow ping pong balls during the middle of a LARP as he's casting lightning bolt. And he's saying lightning bolt to indicate that he's casting a lightning bolt spell. And you know, there's a little reference to that, at least in the trailer, but I think it's actually in the movie too, you know. So their choice of doing that, again, seems like they're approaching this movie as an outsider, as someone like who saw that YouTube video like, oh man, aren't LARPers nerds, you know. A friend of mine who enjoys nerdy stuff himself and is, you know, we get together and play board games and stuff like that, you know, he showed me this video, but he was looking at it from the outside, you know, and he thought it was really funny. He was like, look at this. This guy's pathetic or whatever, you know. And I was like, dude, are you serious? I like I kind of want to be that guy. That looks like a freaking load of fun that he's having there. So anyway, in the end, they didn't go far enough to really make me laugh in this movie, and they didn't stay grounded enough to really make me care about anybody. There were some moments, like I said, that I was like, oh, I'm caring a little bit here. But then they were over, and that investment wasn't retained for the rest of my experience. One or the other would have been great, to go really outlandish or to go more grounded. I think even if they would have gone grounded, they could have still made a really funny movie. It just would have been grounded in emotional realism. But they chose neither, and I think the movie suffers for it. Now, in terms of like things that might be worthwhile to think about or contemplate, or what things that this movie might stimulate as you're watching it or afterward, you know, it does involve summoning a demon, specifically a succubus, with a book of magic. You know, so you've got these kind of extra biblical concepts, you know, like succubi and books of magic and stuff like that, that are really from D&D nerd culture. And, you know, in other movies, doing something like that, like summoning an actual demon with a book of magic, you know, in the real modern world, you know, that might be thought-provoking, because you have to figure out, okay, how am I going to reconcile this if I'm going to suspend disbelief, you know? But this comedy isn't grounded enough in reality for that really to be a factor at all. So I really didn't find anything while watching this movie that made me think about anything worthwhile or contemplate anything, you know, of spiritual significance. So anyway, you know, it's like I said, it's one worth throwing on in the background while you're doing something else, especially if you know, can get it for a really cheap rental. It's rated R for horror, violence, and language throughout, some drug use and sexuality. I give it a quality score of 7.0 out of 10. You know, it's not this failure. It's not this terrible movie. It's just kind of, you know, yeah, throw that on while you're doing something else. And I give it a relevant score of 5.5 out of 10. I do want to remind you guys to check out the other podcasts in the Christian Geek Central network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, and the Untold podcast. For more information about the CGC network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Now, lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
In this segment, I attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of the churchy language we take for granted, using a little cultural history and linguistics now and then to try and get at the heart of the text so we can hopefully see and then apply some of what God has for us in these words today. This time we're looking at Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, chapter 4, verses 1 through 13. I'll read it from the ESV. It says, "Therefore, while the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us fear lest any of you should seem to have failed to reach it. For good news came to us just as to them, but the message they heard did not benefit them because they were not united by faith with those who listened. For we who have believed enter that rest. As he has said, 'As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest.' Although his works were finished from the foundation of the world. For he has somewhere spoken of the seventh day in this way, 'And God rested on the seventh day from all his works.' And again in this passage he said, 'They shall not enter my rest.' Since therefore it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly received the good news failed to enter because of disobedience, again he appoints a certain day, today, saying through David so long afterward, in the words already quoted, 'Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts.' For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. So then there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works, as God did from his. Let us therefore strive to enter that rest, so that no one may fall by the same sort of disobedience. For the word of God is living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing to the division of soul and of spirit, of joints and of marrow, and discerning the thoughts and intentions of the heart. And no creature is hidden from his sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give account." All right. In previous verses, the author warns his readers not to be like the Israelites who left Egypt with Moses. They hardened themselves against God and failed to enter God's rest as a result. The warning continues in these verses, and the idea of rest is explored and applied to a greater degree. Some commentators continue to unconsciously replace the word rest in this passage with justification or eternal life, as though rest here refers to one of these ideas. But it seems more consistent with the context and the rest of Scripture if rest is treated as rest. Surprise! And applied flexibly in accordance with context, much like the Greek word for salvation should be treated. So looking at verses 1 and 2, the author warns readers not to harden themselves against God, but to instead reach for the promise of his rest. A kind of gospel, a kind of good news, came to the ancient Israelites. Broadly speaking, that good news was that God cared for them and wanted to rescue them and deliver them to a place where they would have peace and rest from their labor and oppression. But rather than trust God to lead them to this rest and relief, they largely rebelled, refusing to unite with those few, such as Joshua and Caleb, who chose to trust in the promise of God's rest. Now look at verses 3 through 5. In verse 2, the author states that the Israelites did not enter the promised land of rest because they did not trust Yahweh. They were not united by faith with those who listened. Now in verse 3, we see taught by contrast that those who do trust Yahweh will enter that rest. But verse 3 only seems to use the material from Psalm 95 to reinforce the alternative to trusting Yahweh. The author also states that God's rest began well before the exodus of the Israelites. His works were finished from the foundation of the world. And he supports this by referring readers to the Genesis account of creation, which tells us that God rested on the seventh day. Now, what's interesting to note is that the seventh creation day in Genesis chapter 2 does not include the phrase, "and there was evening and morning," as the previous six-day descriptions do. Many scholars conclude that the seventh creation day is actually still going on right now, and that God, creatively speaking, continues in a kind of rest until the creation of the new heaven and new earth, as described in Revelation 21:1. Now, this being the case, when God says, "my rest," he doesn't just mean a rest that he's providing. It's a rest he himself is participating in that he invites us to join, an idea that's also consistent with the partnership concept of Hebrews 3:14, which we looked at last time. So we're invited to join Yahweh in both his work and his rest. Now, verses 6 through 10, the author makes the case here that the Israelites never fully entered into the rest Yahweh offered them. The implication of Psalm 95, written long after the Exodus, is that there is a kind of rest remaining that can be entered into. And the author of Hebrews teaches that the offer to enter this rest still stands. There is a clear present tense element to this rest. It's something that can be experienced now. And given that the invitation to this rest is paired so closely in Hebrews with the invitation to join in the household affairs of God, it seems that this rest is surprisingly experienced while we serve Jesus. Jesus himself describes this kind of rest amidst work in Matthew 11, 28 through 30. You guys have heard these words before. "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." The implication seems to be that we are able to rest from our efforts to get on God's good side or earn his favor, something even those of us who have been believers for years can still find ourselves doing. We can now rest from all that crap. We can rest from any obligation to prove our own value or significance. We're still meant to take on the yoke of Jesus and learn from him. We're still meant to be a part of his household affairs. But our efforts no longer need to be burdened by frustration when we fail or when we fall short. Our rest comes from knowing that God's rescue plan can't be thwarted, either intentionally by those opposing God or accidentally by those of us following him. There's also a future tense element to this rest, implied by the tense of verse 9 and the unique Greek word the author just momentarily switches to for Sabbath rest, which is used nowhere else in Scripture. It seems this promised present tense rest will culminate in a further future kind of rest that has something in common with the Old Testament Sabbath day, perhaps in the sense of additional celebration of and focus on Yahweh. Now, verses 11 through 13. So how do we strive to enter that rest in the meantime, as verse 11 refers to? Well, I think we do that in pursuit of and in submission to the truth that God has verbally revealed, His Word, which verses 12 and 13 are all about. At some point in the future, we will give an accurate account of our lives to Jesus, and the Word He has revealed will be the measuring stick in that moment. We know that there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. I want to be clear about that. We see that in Romans 8:1. But the additional reward and blessing we receive from Him on that day will be in direct proportion to how we responded to His revealed Word throughout our day-to-day lives. Now, I think as geeks, looking at this passage, we can respond to this right now by asking ourselves, okay, am I caught up in efforts to make good impressions or gain significance? Do I give so much weight to the opinions of others and their opinions of me specifically that I'm weighed down by insecurity? Am I laboring to define myself and ignoring the fact that Yahweh has defined me already? I can frequently answer yes to all of those uncomfortable questions. I think maybe at some point today I could have answered yes to each and every one of those. My default mode involves the stressful pursuit of justifying my worth to people, even if people don't notice that that's what's going on, or if it's not obvious. Maybe sometimes it is, but that's what's going on in my mind so often. To just trying to justify my worth to people, justify my worth to God, justify my worth to His kingdom plans. And when I'm in that mode, I feel more insecure, I feel more defensive, I feel more unfulfilled, and more frustrated. The more weight I give the opinions that others have of me, the more draining and difficult it is for me to spend time with people in general. But I've begun noticing that when my mind is in the right place, engaging in the household affairs God has prepped for me in that moment, when I'm trusting that His love and not my efforts or attributes, His love rescues me and gives me worth, then I'm more emotionally just at ease and more useful to others in my life, to other believers in my life. My mind is not in the right place near as often as I'd like. I'd invite you to join me in striving to take the truths of God that we may only hold at kind of a comfortable intellectual distance and bring them near to the heart, choosing to trust in what God has revealed about Himself and what He's revealed about us. I'm convinced that kind of striving is a much easier yoke and a lighter burden than what we burden ourselves with. And one that increasingly brings us to the rest and the relief that we're aching for.
Feedback in part.
I want to hear from you guys. Request a review, give me your thoughts, questions, whatever. Really, it all helps me make the show better.
That part of my voice. I think I'm gonna do the rest of the podcast right here.
Go to spiritblade.net/underground to record a message with your computer, or send me an email at paeter@spiritblade.net. Summer freeze coming. Can you guys smell it? It's coming, it's coming, it's coming. I've been getting some suggestions from you guys, which I really appreciate, over on the forums. Send me some more. Either submissions, if you want to highlight something yourself, you can write it out, or you can record me something to use on the show. I'd love to get it from you, or you can just send me a suggestion, and if I have some time, then I will check it out myself. Got to be 100% no gray areas legal, and of course, of specific interest to geeks, and that's it. All right, well, so far as I record this, it's been a great week going off-grid, so I apologize if you've been trying to email me and haven't heard a response yet. I've been working on Spirit-Laid World of Shadows. It's been really nice. Reminds me of the old days, before I was doing a podcast and I was just sitting in a hole and just working on audio dramas and nothing else, which did get monotonous, so the podcast is definitely a nice way to shake things up and make my life a little more varietous. Is that a word? Yes, varietous. Stay tuned for Farscape Shawarma, guys, after the credits, if that's the kind of thing you'd be into. Or jump back to episode 310 to start from the beginning. Next week, if God wants it to happen, that is, I'm going to review Godzilla. I haven't seen a single trailer for this yet. Not a single one. I just know that it's coming out. I have no idea what to expect. Hopefully I don't have the old Matthew Broderick. Yeah. Almost forgot his name. Hopefully I don't have that movie to expect, something better than that. But anyway, we'll see. Till then, thanks so much for making time for the show. I hope you have a great week and that you join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out in one breath and seek the truth.
Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Frenson with support from the Christian Geek Central community at christiangeekcentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit spiritblade.net. Thank you for listening.
Prepare for immediate starburst.
All right, thanks for sticking around again for Farscape Shawarma. This time talking about Farscape Season 1, Episode 104, Throne for a Loss. And now we're finally starting to get into some of the better episodes of Season 1. After seeing this one, my memory did come back, and I remember that, yes, this definitely was the first episode that I ever saw of Farscape. And I was reminded again of why I was just like, I have got to try, I've got to come back and watch. I want to see more of this show, you know. Almost a done deal just in one episode alone. Probably one of the strongest episodes, if not of the season, then certainly of the first half of the season. Just a great episode. Some things that popped out to me this time while I was watching it. Hey, Dargo's got no contacts, you know, which I thought was just great. I think that you can just see more of Anthony Simcoe's eyes and what he's doing. You know, I've heard actors talk about, and Anthony Simcoe has talked about this as well, about, you know, you lose your pupil dilation when you have contacts on. And there's, you know, I'm like, really? I don't even know that I noticed that ever in actors, you know, their pupil dilations. But I think it's probably something going on a more very subtle subconscious level that we're not consciously aware of. But I do certainly notice that when an actor has contacts in, that forces their irises to be in this fixed, you know, level of openness or whatever, that it does kind of, you know, cut them off. It does make them less relatable emotionally somehow in a way that's not really identifiable. So, when I saw his real eyes, I was like, oh, there's Dargo. The Dargo I know is starting to slowly come out. And there was also some choices he made with his voice that, up to this point, he's just been keeping this, you know, this really, you know, strong trailery kind of voice all the time, you know, this really strong kind of, you know, singular Dargo level voice. And now he's kind of allowing that voice to soften up now and then and get some different colors going on and just showing a little bit more, I don't know if vulnerability is the word, but just a little bit more
Those are moments where he's letting down his guard a little bit, and you're seeing a little bit more of who Dargo is. And so we're starting to see that as of this episode. Really enjoyable. Man, cool stuff conceptually going on in this episode. The gauntlet needles, you know, that's this kind of really visceral, like, you know, like this gadget that kind of wounds you as you use it. You know, it's just not the kind of thing you're going to see really on Star Trek. It's a little, it's a subtle thing. It's not gory by any means, but it's just a little bit too for your average Star Trek episode. And in that opening sequence, great action and great effects. I love the kind of plasma trail that follows behind the blasts from the gauntlets. Just really cool looking visual effects. In something, you know, as simple as a blaster, they take the time to give it this visual look that's really cool and, you know, just mesmerizing and just makes you wonder what's going on. What makes that blast different from your average, you know, blaster weapon, you know? I love the costume designs of the Tavleks. I almost call them Tavloids, which is a great running gag through the whole episode. And the design on Bakesh, or Bakesh, depending on which actor is saying their name. I say Bakesh because I think that's what they, you know... Never mind, I won't get into that. Minor spoiler alert. Not spoiler alert, almost spoiler. I'll avoid that. Anyway, anyway, I loved his helmet design where it's just like, how is he seeing out of that? I mean, it doesn't even look like a sunglass type thing. It's just like solid metal over his... you know, entire, you know, upper face, you know. And in fact, the actor couldn't see. They had to move him around. The guy playing Bakesh, he couldn't see any time while he was in that costume. And you really don't get a sense of that unless you're really looking for it, I suppose, maybe in one shot. But, you know, it's just amazing what they did with him without him being able to see anything. Just a great look. And all those costumes for, you know, for all the Tavleks, you know, they're all textured and they're battered. They've seen battles and stuff. And this is like feature film quality costumes, you know, just fantastic. They're not a bunch of cookie cutter sci-fi armor things. You know, it's like each one of those Tavleks, their armor has history to it, you know, individual history from battles of the past. I don't think even today you see that in weekly television. I mean, it was just crazy cool. The pop culture references in this one, they're definitely getting better, but they're still not completely natural, especially at the beginning, you know, when he brings up John Wayne and he lists off these John Wayne movies to her, and I'm like, well, why in the world would he even bother listing those off? He's got to know that she hasn't seen any of those. But there are some better references later on that come a little bit more naturally, I think, like when he mentions to Pilot, he's like, Pilot, you know, use a tractor beam to do this, and Pilot's like, tractor beam, you know, just this vocabulary we take for granted, and it's, what was that, docking web, I think is what they, what it's called, instead. So, you know, really great stuff. And the Wile E. Coyote reference, you know, where he's like, Wile E. Coyote would have a better plan than that, you know. That was just great. And then I think this little bit was improvised when he was in the ship heading down to the planet with Aaron. And he says, next time you hit me, you better make sure I don't wake up. And she's like, and he's like, oh, don't me, you know. And I'm almost positive that was improvised. And as of this episode, I started getting a feeling that, like, maybe even the Wile E. Coyote thing might have been improvised. I just feel like his pop culture references and his little, you know, idiosyncrasies, you know, in his dialogue were starting to click, starting to feel a little bit more natural in this episode. And I was like, yes, we're starting to see now the classic John dialogue and the classic John Crichton deliveries of these little, you know, jokes and pop culture references. The action in this episode was great as well. And one of the reasons it was great was that it was like character-driven action. You know, for the first half of the story, the big conflict that we see being played out is amongst the protagonists, who are each taking their turn wearing the gauntlet and, you know, experiencing its effects, and it's bringing out all their aggression and stuff like that. And so they're like attacking each other, and so the action sequences also have this very character driven and emotional component behind them. And yeah, you know, it's great. Instead of it's just like, oh, what hostile alien race is this? They're mean. You know, it's like these actions, these combat fighting sequences between protagonists. You know, really, really great stuff. Let's see here. Oh yeah, there was one scene where I saw Dargo had one contact back in, and I believe that's because I was listening to some of the commentaries of the previous episodes earlier today, and these first four episodes they shot in pairs, basically. So they shot episodes simultaneously. I believe they broke away from that and just began shooting them, you know, as single episodes, do all of one episode, you know, mostly anyway, at a time. Whereas this, they were, you know, kind of doing some of the same, you know, jumping back and forth between episodes as it worked with their schedule and their locations that they were at and stuff like that. So actually the locations for this one, I think, are some of the same ones for an episode or two ago, but they use this cool, and this is in the commentary, I believe, but they use this cool color filtering effect to make the leaves blue. I mean, those weren't blue plants that they found somewhere, and they didn't paint a bunch of plants blue. That was a color filtering effect, and it really looks great. Yeah, just really cool stuff that they're doing. Let's see here. Oh yeah, the Consortium of Trow Monarch was a little bit of a disappointment. You know, you could tell that's not one of the best puppets that's appeared on this show. The eyes didn't move at all. The tentacles weren't very articulated. You know, certainly not to the degree that, say, Pilot is. But I think they help some of that by masking him. And this is something they do a lot on Farscape, is that the camera will often have objects and things in front of it so that your view of things is a little bit obscured, and the camera might be moving, and then objects in the foreground will be passing over and just momentarily blocking the camera's view as it pans from one side of the room to the other. And I think they did, you know, they had the monarch of the Consortium of Trow sitting inside of this cell the whole time. And so there was almost always something kind of blocking him. And so I think that helped, you know, to let your imagination fill in the gaps a little bit, given the shortcomings of the puppet itself. But there were still definitely some shortcomings in that puppet compared to what more we have seen, and certainly what more we will see on this show. Let's see here. Okay, Rigel. We saw more of Rigel's character as well. You know, he's clearly pompous, but he's also intelligent, and he's crafty, and he's trying to make the best of his situation, trying to use the food that was dumped in his cell to kind of loosen up the soil and make his escape, you know, even though the escape attempt failed. You know, he's still a very resourceful guy. And then he also had this moment of vulnerability, you know, when he admitted to the monarch in the cell next to him, you know, I don't have anybody that's going to come and get me, you know. And he was laughing at the monarch for, you know, agreeing to pay his ransom under false, you know, pretenses. Maybe pretense isn't the right word, but misunderstanding, I guess, of Rigel's situation. You know, and then the monarch says basically, well, then why are you laughing? You know, and his laughter kind of dies down, and there's this little whimper from Rigel. And in that moment, he's just for a second, he's likable, you know? And I think it's moments like that make Rigel, rather than being kind of like an annoying character, like Zan is to me, and like other characters that we'll see in the future are also kind of annoying to me, Rigel to me is one that from almost the very beginning is fun to hate. You love to hate Rigel, and after a while you're not even hating him anymore, you're just plain loving him, you know? The Luxon blood concept was introduced this time in this episode, where when a Luxon, you know, bleeds, that the wound has to be, you know, aggravated until the blood runs clear. Otherwise, it's, you know, poisonous and it's infected, and then they'll die from the wound. And man, I think that's just a cool concept from this warrior race. And maybe that says something about how they became such great warriors. You know, they became such great warriors. They had to, you know, be great offensively and defensively, because just one little wound could potentially be fatal to them. You know, so I just really like that concept. And that's something that's going to carry on and going to be referenced. And they're not going to explain, I don't think, ever again, at least not in the detail of this episode, you know? So, I mean, if you come in a later episode where he gets wounded and they're like beating the crap out of him and, you know, you're not going to know what the crap is going on or why they're beating the crap out of him, you know? So you just have to be invested. But, you know, not explaining that in future episodes makes those episodes more layered, you know, because there's stuff going on in the subtexts based on stuff that you know from previous episodes. So it makes all the future stories that you watch that are going to use that little device all that more rich and layered. And that is just going to happen more and more and more as this series continues. They're going to continue to layer and demand that you recall information from previous episodes in order to appreciate and to understand what's going on in the episode at hand. So that's just one teeny tiny example of them setting something up, establishing something that's going to carry forward. Let's see here. The Tavlex, man, the design on the Tavlex and their makeup. Wow. Wow. I mean, these guys looked like they, I mean, this is, again, this is feature film stuff, I think, you know, this makeup is feature film stuff on a weekly television show that even today, there's nobody else that's doing this. I mean, good grief. This 1999 is when this episode came out, 1999. And I'm still not seeing any show that on a weekly basis does this kind of makeup, this kind of diverse makeup, this diverse effects. Creatures, I mean, good gravy, you know? There are some things that I would say are dated, and if they were to do this show now, it would be, I think, that much better in terms of makeup and puppetry and stuff like that, but good grief. It's, in so many ways, this show holds up amazingly well because of all of its practical visuals. But yeah, these tablets, they look like they were ripped open and reassembled. They've got like big cracks in their face and staples holding them together. And I just noticed this time when the younger Tavlek who was on the ship with Zan, he's got a little like a divot, you know, little chunk missing from the top of his head. And there's a little, like you can see a metal plate in there. So it just gets my mind working. There's just a story there in the makeup alone. You're just wondering, what have these guys done to themselves in order to make themselves into the warriors they are? What have, you know, the gauntlet is just, my impression is the gauntlet is just one way in which they have chosen to sacrifice their health to become better warriors, you know? And I think the makeup job is a further indication of what these guys have done to themselves to make them who they are. Let's see here. Oh, I have to acknowledge the Green Lantern reference when Crichton puts on, you know, he's looking at the gauntlet trying to figure out how it works, and, you know, it's like, oh, willpower, okay, like the Green Lantern ring, you know? And I was like, sold! Because if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you know that the Green Lantern is my absolute favorite superhero concept. Just love it, love it, love it. And I couldn't believe that anybody was referencing Green Lantern. I mean, this was before Geoff Johns took over Green Lantern and made him a popular comic book in DC Comics, and of course well before the movie with Ryan Reynolds. I mean, I was a hardcore Green Lantern fan. No one else was. I would say Green Lantern to people and they'd say, oh yeah, yeah, I love Kato, you know? And I'm like, no, that's Green Hornet, you know? Green Hornet. Green Lantern's totally different, you know? And these guys knew who Green Lantern was. That they got huge credit, huge nerd credit with me, you know. That was awesome. That was awesome. Oh, and you know, just great inventive stuff, like in the fight scene with the Crichton and Bakesh when they're shooting back and forth, and then suddenly Crichton like catches an energy ball and throws it back. We didn't know the gauntlet could do that. He just did it, you know. It was just like, oh man, they're just doing innovative stuff and just expecting you as an audience member to just come along for the ride and just accept what's going on and just enjoy the innovation and craziness of it all. Anyway, episode ended on I think a good note where Zan, you know, basically was not able to convince the Tavlek that was on the ship with her to, you know, give up the gauntlet. And, you know, she kind of ends, the last line of the episode is no sermons, you know. And I think that kind of ending, that kind of unresolved, unhappy, as it were, ending is a lot more popular today. But when this show came out, that was not happening. It was a very rare thing, at least in Star Trek and Andromeda, and you know, it was it just wasn't near as common. So yeah, so that was neat. Okay, well, this was a great episode. I went on much longer than I thought. I thought I was going to be just talking a mile a minute and get through all my notes and thoughts really fast, but great, great episode. Next episode, not as good in my book, but still has some great Hallmark Farscape stuff going on, some Farscape weirdness, and still a very, I think, enjoyable episode that that I think will keep your interest. So come on back next time as we look at episode 105, Back and Back and Back to the Future.